From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
50 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, we revisit his final hours.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will.
We'll also look back on how Boston reacted to the news of King's death.
We in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace.
Plus, King's legacy and the work yet to be done.
See, that's it. You cannot give up, because if we give up, then we give in.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. April 4th, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee. Just one day after Dr. Martin Luther King gave what would be his final speech.
Trouble is in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars.
NBC interrupts its regular program schedule to bring you the following special report.
Dr. Martin Luther King has been shot and wounded, possibly critically wounded, in Memphis, Tennessee this evening.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place.
Dr. King left his room 306 at the Lorraine Hotel just before dinner to get some air. Police say 205 feet away, in a window in a flophouse, the assassin waited.
But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will.
Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street.
I said, Dr. King. That was it. I said, Dr. King, just as he straightened up. He said, Dr. King, and the bullet exploded in his face.
And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men.
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
On April 5th, President Lyndon Johnson addressed the nation.
Once again, the heart of America is heavy. The spirit of America weeps for a tragedy that denies the very meaning of our land.
And in Boston, Mayor Kevin White pleaded for peace.
24 hours ago, Dr. King died for all of us, black and white. That we may live together in harmony without violence and in peace. This is our city, and its future is in our hands. Tonight, and tomorrow, and the days that follow.
Well, here we are in 2018 and the days that follow. In this special hour of Radio Boston, we'll look back on King's assassination and its aftermath, how that moment in Memphis 50 years ago still shudders through American history and America's present. And listeners, we want to hear from you. Were you there? Do you remember that moment? Does it still live with you? And how does Dr. King's legacy resonate through the challenges of America in 2018? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We'll begin today with Tennessee native Joseph Rosenblum. He was an intern at the Morning Daily in Memphis during the summer of 1968 following King's death. He went on to become a reporter at the Boston Globe and at PBS's Frontline. In Rosenblum's new book, Redemption, he examines King's last 31 hours and 28 minutes from the time King touched down in Memphis on Eastern Airlines Flight 381 on the morning of April 3, 1968, to the moment he was shot at 6:01 p.m. on April 4th. And Joe Rosenblum joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on.
So I'm looking at the title of your book, Redemption. And I was just wondering if you might remind us why it was that Dr. King went to Memphis on April 3rd, 1968 in the first place.
Well, this was his third visit to Memphis in that year. The first visit on March the 18th, he addressed a rally for the sanitation workers who were on strike. Back 10 days later to lead a march that turned quickly into a riot. And he was being widely condemned after the riot for having lost command of his movement, that he was being accused of no longer being a nonviolent leader. And he felt that he had to go back to Memphis and lead another march, a march that he was vowing would remain nonviolent, so that he could restore his credibility as a nonviolent leader.
I mean, you write in your book that it was for the first time in a decade his name didn't appear on a poll of the 10 most admired Americans.
Yeah, so he had been greatly admired until about 1966 when he suffered a series of reversals. The Chicago campaign that didn't go well. There were the inner city riots and so on. And that knocked him off that list of the most admired Americans.
Yeah. I mean, King himself, as you write in the book, 1968 was a very difficult year for him. You call him a man in distress, and the strain of perhaps losing control of his movement was taking a toll on him both emotionally and physically.
Yeah, he was physically in bad shape by the spring of 1968. He was completely exhausted. He'd been on the road. He was campaigning for what he called the Poor People's Campaign, and that was extremely exhausting. He had been dealing with a bad cold when he arrived in Memphis, had a sore throat, and he was increasingly hearing about threats against his life, and that was very much weighing on him as he went to Memphis. Then there was that riot that I mentioned, and his spirits sank even lower then as he was dealing with the criticism over the riot.
Yeah. So tell me more about the Poor People's Campaign, because here we are several years after the Civil Rights Act had been signed. And King is both championing the issues of inequality, economic inequality. Also, he's campaigning against the Vietnam War. So how was the Poor People's Campaign, or was it, significantly different from the work he'd been doing before?
Well, his core mission for his first decade as a civil rights leader had been pretty much in the South, where he was moving as aggressively as he could to desegregate the Jim Crow South, and at the same time to work for voting rights for African Americans. So it was the cause in the South for African Americans and equality and civil rights. Then he pivoted in about 1966 and looked northward and began to try to improve the conditions, the deplorable conditions in the slums of America, and more broadly, to work for economic justice for African Americans, but also for all impoverished Americans. And then the Poor People's Campaign was his way of trying to do something about poverty in America.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the speech he had given a couple of weeks earlier on March 18th in Memphis to rally support for sanitation workers and their strike in the city. We actually have a moment from that speech. This is Dr. Martin Luther King at the Bishop Charles Mason Temple of the Church of God in Christ.
So often we overlook the worth and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth.
So that's Dr. King a couple of weeks before April 4th, when he was assassinated. In your book, Redemption, you write about how when he arrived in Memphis and checks into the Lorraine Hotel, there is a surveillance detail following him, right?
There is. There was a two-man surveillance detail, two undercover police officers, both African-American, as it happened. And they were monitoring his every move from the time he arrived at the airport until he was shot on the night of April the 4th. Now, in one case, one of them was asked to not to continue as of early afternoon on that day of the 4th because there had been threats. His name was Ed Reddit, and there were threats against his life, and the police headquarters decided that there was too much risk for him to continue near the Lorraine, so he was pulled off. But the second gentleman, a guy named Willie Richmond, a police officer in Memphis, did continue to watch King until the very last minute.
Huh. So while he was there, though, I mean, did he have a sense that there had been threats made against him in Memphis?
He did. There were more and more threats all the time. I mean, threats were a constant of his life from the moment he emerged as a civil rights leader in Montgomery, Alabama. But they had been intensifying, and he had the sense that his life was in greater danger all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, so who... It's interesting because now we're looking back with the privilege of 50 years later. And I suppose part of me wants to say if he knew that the threats were growing and intensifying against him all the time, why did he press on with his desire to lead a march, you know, of sanitation workers in Memphis, even after actually a U.S. District Court judge had issued an injunction or a restraining order against the march?
Yeah, there was an injunction issued on that morning of April 3rd, the very morning that he arrived back in Memphis. He decided to contest the injunction, and there was a hearing the next day, and the judge lifted the injunction subject to certain restrictions on the march that was then scheduled for the following Monday on April the 8th. That he pressed ahead because he was so deeply committed to continuing the his campaign, first of all, for poverty, and then more generally for civil rights and economic justice. And he had reached the point in his life where he was willing to risk all. He didn't think he was going to be killed. He was pretty much certain of it. It wasn't a matter of if, it was more when. And yet he thought it was worth the sacrifice, worth the risk that he would, he continued.
And to just reiterate something you said before, was there also this pressing need that he felt to lead a successful nonviolent march in order to reestablish sort of the moral authority of his nonviolent movement?
Yeah, so he wanted to establish his credibility that everyone was saying, not everyone, but he was being pilloried by politicians and by newspaper editorials, saying that he had lost his way, that he no longer could control his protests, that they would turn into riots. And he wanted to demonstrate that that was false, that he could have another march and that it would stay peaceful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to that point, when Dr. King was in Memphis, he met with the Invaders, right, a Black Power group. We have some tape here of Martin Luther King speaking about these groups. This particular tape is from 1966 in an interview that King gave to 60 Minutes' Mike Wallace.
And I contend that the cry of Black Power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary to make justice a reality for the Negro. I think we've got to see that a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the economic plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years.
Joe Rosenblum, in 1968, what were the interactions between King and groups like the Invaders like?
Well, the Invaders were a local Black Power group. They got their name from a popular TV program at the time. And they were dubious about the kind of civil rights campaign that King had been waging. They thought that was ineffective, that it wasn't aggressive enough. They were also Black nationalists, and they didn't believe so much in integration, which was a cardinal principle of Martin Luther King's. So he did meet with them and tried to dissuade them from at least in rhetoric, if not in action, from talking about violence and how they had to defend themselves violently if necessary, that sort of thing. And it, writ large, that's what was happening in the nation. The Black Power movement, Stokely Carmichael, H.R.A.P. Brown were two of the best-known leaders. They were saying very much the same things. And King was concerned, especially as he was leading this Poor People's Campaign to Washington, that the Black Power insurgency would undermine what he was going to try to do in Washington.
Mm. Well, so here we are then. There's so much to discuss. Your book goes, again, your book covers 31 hours, a finite period of time in such detail. But I want to get to the point that we heard at the very beginning of the show today, the night before King's assassination, when he gives what became his final speech, the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech. And I want to play another moment from that.
Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strike, but either we go up together or we go down together.
It's Dr. Martin Luther King on the night of April 3rd, 1968. Did people have a sense at that moment? I mean, the power of the speech is inescapable, but did anybody have a sense at that moment as to what its significance would be?
Well, I think they probably had a sense that it was a particularly extraordinary speech. I mean, he gave many extraordinary speeches. But the eloquence of those words, as you heard, the emotion that he evoked in that speech, I think people sensed that it was a special speech. I mean, for one thing, by the end of the speech, people were absolutely ecstatic about it. People were crying and shouting, and so it was that kind of speech. But it was especially the finale of the speech, I think, that had the greatest impact on people in that Mason Temple at the time.
Right. And, of course, again, looking back, it's hard not to wonder if he really did sense that eventually. I mean, he's talking about his own death in a way, but not there's no way he could have known that the next day it would come.
No. I mean, he didn't know about when, but he was feeling a deep, deep, deep dread that it could happen at any moment, that he could be killed. And in the end of the speech, in that finale, some of which you paid in your introduction, he talks about his mortality, and he's kind of coming to terms with it in a way that I think he had never done as openly and emotionally as he did that night. And so I think that was a part of the reason that people responded as they did. They were, I think, quite staggered by the speech.
Yeah. So it's 6:01 p.m. on the following day, April 4, 1968, where he's shot and killed. You end your book with a very compelling line. You end your book saying that Dr. King imagined that he would die with a sense of redemptive virtue. That was the compensation he sought. I mean, he's dead. He died. But I feel as if 50 years later, yes, indeed, he had been redeemed from the struggles. He has been, of course, redeemed from the struggles that he entered 1968 with. But tell me more about that.
What he meant by redemptive value, redemptive virtue, he was thinking of a biblical connotation there. So, of course, Jesus sacrificed himself, according to Christian theology, to save or redeem all humanity of their sin. And borrowing that notion and applying it to himself, King believed that his sacrifice, even to the point of death, for the cause of racial and economic justice would have redemptive value for him in a very personal way and in the Christian sense.
Well, Joe Rosenblum's book is Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours. Joe Rosenblum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Meghna, for having me.
So we just talked about the last 31 hours before Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis on April 4th, 1968. When we come back, we'll look at the aftermath of his assassination, both here in Boston, across America, and around the world. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're observing the 50th anniversary and aftermath of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was cut down by a sniper's bullet on April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. The next day, April 5th, Robert Kennedy chartered the American Electra airplane that took King's body home to Atlanta. That night, CBS News aired this special report.
Good evening. This is Harry Reasoner. A day after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, the nation has two questions. One, has the murderer been caught? And two, what has the effect been?
Reasoner assured Americans, most likely white Americans, that the nation had not yet caught fire. But he did describe what he called the smoke of racial vandalism rising in several cities.
Washington, Chicago, Detroit, Boston, New York, these are just a few of the cities in which the Negro anguish over Dr. King's murder, presumably by a white man, expressed itself in violent destruction.
Reasoner had the gravitas of the old-school news anchor, but he had it wrong about Boston. Yes, there was some unrest, but not the explosive violence seen in other cities.
We didn't want Boston to go up in the same kind of flames that other cities were facing.
Sarah Ann Shaw was WBZ's first ever black female television reporter. She covered the city for more than 30 years.
That day, people were calling each other and said, have you heard? Have you heard? Is it true? Is it true? No, I think people were just so stunned. We heard it, but I'm sure that I didn't really believe that it had happened.
Shaw recalls how on the night of April 5th, James Brown was scheduled to play the Boston Garden. He did.
It's getting late in the evening. I can't get right. I guess I did the boogaloo. The funky Broadway. God.
Boston Mayor Kevin White had urged Brown not only to go on with the show, but also to televise it live on WGBH. He did that, too. And that night, the Godfather of Soul introduced Boston's mayor to the stage.
Mayor Kevin White, give him a big round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. He's a swinging cat.
Mayor White urged peace.
Martin Luther King loved this city, and it's up to our generation to prove his faith in us. So all I ask you tonight is this. So let us look at each other, here in the gardens and back at home, and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace.
Boston answered the call. Sarah Ann Shaw says,
and it worked.
But that's right. What people say, God and Abel, God down in May. But I got a key that to down. That to down. It's still.
James Brown in Boston on April 5th, 1968. Well, joining me now is Jason Sokol. He's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the new book, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Walter Fluker. He's the Martin Luther King Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology. He's also editor of the Howard Thurman Papers Project and the director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Initiative for the Development of Ethical Leadership. Walter Fluker, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
So you heard in that little piece that I put together, Mayor White mentioning King's love of Boston and Boston's love of Dr. King. What do you think it was about that relationship between the man and the city that perhaps allowed less unrest here on April 5th than we saw in other American cities?
I can't speak directly to how King's love of the city would have impacted that, but I do think that the size of the Boston population of African Americans had probably much to do with that. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I can assure you it was quite different that evening there. But the size, but I do think that with James Brown being present, it provided a kind of palliative for the crowds that were there. And certainly Kevin White, whom I understand really didn't know who James Brown was able to use that very effectively and should be applauded.
So, I mean, you were in Chicago in 1968 on the day and the aftermath of King's assassination. I mean, give us a comparison. What was it like in Chicago?
Well, we in Chicago, there were riots, especially on the west side. I was on the south side of Chicago. And many of those neighborhoods, even now, are still struggling to come back. There was burning, there was looting, and a lot of violence. And I was sharing with my colleague here that I remember that evening my father, who was a very peaceful man, the sorrow and the rage that were intermixed. And I think his feelings were emblematic of what was happening throughout the city among African Americans in particular.
Yeah. Jason Sokol, I mean, reflect with me on that. What do you hear in Walter Fluker's experience?
Well, I think so many African Americans alternated between grief and rage, and that was African Americans across the country. I read essays from high school students in Memphis to older generations of African Americans across northern cities, and they, even African Americans who disagreed with King about violence and nonviolence, still felt this profound loss, even as others were moved to more violent action.
Well, in your book, you contrast that to the reactions of white Americans. I mean, because we have the tendency now to play the tape from, which we've done this hour and we probably will do more, play the tape from President Johnson. We have the tendency to play Robert Kennedy's famous speech in Indianapolis. But the truth of white America's reaction in 1968 was far more varied than that.
It was extremely diverse. I mean, there was even some white some white Americans who rejoiced at King's assassination. They thought King was a rabble-rouser, an agitator, a troublemaker, and this was because of his Poor People's Campaign, his opposition to the Vietnam War. And they basically thought he had it coming. There are other whites, there are, you know, a segment of liberal whites who joined with African Americans in grief and loss. And then there was a large majority of white people who just weren't all that impressed by King's assassination one way or another. You know, these are people who had grieved at President Kennedy's assassination and would grieve at Robert Kennedy's, but they felt that many whites felt that the wound of King's death was a wound felt by black people and not by them.
Interesting. I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from an ABC News report on the night of Dr. King's death, speaking with children on the streets of Harlem.
Well, it's a feeling of partly sadness and mostly hatred because, they didn't really want him to die like he died. They want, you know, to die, you know. They didn't want him to die like he died.
You say hatred.
Yeah.
What is the hatred aimed at?
At mostly the white people.
Why?
Because it was a white man that shot Martin Luther King.
Walter Fluker, how do you react to that?
I think he was speaking his truth.
Yeah.
And it certainly was not unusual for people to feel that way. I mentioned my father's rage, but I had even there were repercussions beyond his assassination. I remember the next month we were playing another high school football, and I was part of one of the biggest riots I'd ever witnessed and still have witnessed anywhere. After the game, all of the black students just began to jump on the white students in the middle of the street. And it was a direct result, I think, of the King assassination and the deep, harrowing uncertainty about the future.
Yeah.
And rage.
Well, so contrast that then with what you write in your book, Jason Sokol, about how deeply the hatred or sort of white America, some of white America's hatred of Dr. King is evidence in the way some children responded to King's death. I'm seeing here that you write, among white students in Florida's public schools, for instance, 41% thought the assassination was King's own fault. 17% believe the killer ought to receive congratulations.
Yeah, and I mean, So it goes to show that it wasn't just an older version. It wasn't just an older generation of white Southerners who had this hatred for King. The children absorbed that hatred, and then they parroted the criticisms they had heard from their parents and their leaders. And I read through a series of essays that white children wrote at a Memphis area high school. Their teacher asked them to write what they thought about King's assassination. And essay after essay, they said, well, the assassin is a great patriot, or, you know, amen, or King received his just deserts.
Mm. So I want to play something else here, Walter Fluker, because you are the editor of the Howard Thurman papers. We have some tape here of Howard Thurman himself, who was the dean of BU's Marsh Chapel, served as Dr. King's mentor as well. Is that fair to say?
He was a mentor,
yeah.
Yes.
Now, he delivered a statement following Dr. King's assassination. He gave the statement at the church that he had co-founded with Dr. King in San Francisco.
There are no words with which to eulogize this man. Martin Luther King was the living epitome of a way of life that rejected physical violence as the lifestyle of a morally responsible people. His assassination reveals the cleft deep in the psyche of the American people.
Walter Fluker, I mean, tell me more about how Howard Thurman responded to that moment and about the relationship that he had with Dr. King.
Very quickly, Howard Thurman knew the King family. His wife,
yeah.
Sue, actually went to school with Berta King at Spelman. They were both Morehouse men. They knew one another. But Thurman was the first African-American to lead a delegation to meet with Mahatma Gandhi in 1936. and wrote a little book entitled Jesus and the Disinherited, which we know that King read in 1949 when it was first released. And later, King comes to Boston University in 1951, and Thurman is invited as the first African-American dean at BU, the dean of Mars Chapel. And King and Thurman actually celebrate the World Series in the fall of 1953. Perhaps the most poignant event in King's career was after the stabbing in 1958,
right,
when he was signing. He was hospitalized in Harlem, and Thurman went to visit. And we've collected correspondence between the two men. And Thurman recommends to King that he take a longer convalescence and that he devote himself to prayer and thought. And King, as far as we know, had never taken that kind of time during his experience as leader of the movement. Shortly thereafter, several months later, King is on his way to India. And we know that before King went to India, he was a practitioner of nonviolent resistance, but he had not devoted it, his life to it as a philosophy of life. He returned, of course, being convinced that nonviolence was the only way to bring about a society that would be just and would raise people to a place of justice and love.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but when we hear Howard Thurman in the immediate aftermath of King's assassination talking about that the assassination reveals the cleft deep in the psyche of the American people, I mean, did King's death set back? I keep coming back to the fact that we're here in 2018, but in 1968, in the immediate aftermath, did King's death set back that goal of racial justice through nonviolent means?
I think it revealed what was already there. I think it was a revelation. It was the very same claim that W.E.B. Du Bois and others had said, that the 20th century would be the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. And I think in many ways, what was revealed then has even been further exasperated by some current political and other events.
Yeah. Jason Sokol, what's your thought on that? I mean, that's basically the heart of your book, right?
Yeah, it is. I think part of what Walter means was it was revealing what was already there, is there was this schism within the black freedom struggle over, are you going to try nonviolence? Are you going to be more militant? And King was one of the last people who was trying to talk to both sides. I mean, he was one of the last figures who had legitimacy with both camps. And once he was gone, I think that the hopes of bringing the movement together, the hopes also of bringing whites and blacks together, were set back greatly, and then revealed this persistent white hatred, which has also, I think, endured up until our time.
Set back greatly, but for how long? I mean, all the way to today?
I think that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
There was a division, of course, among African-American leadership regarding the pros and cons of nonviolent resistance. But what I was saying is that this deep cleft, this chasm that Thurman is alluding to, was indeed the problem of racism in our society. And, of course, we've seen it in many ways expand, maybe even deepen in some other kind of ways.
Mm.
Charlottesville would be one example of that.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about this when we come back from a quick break. I'm joined today by Walter Fluker. He's the Martin Luther King Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology, and also by Jason Sokol, Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And we are observing the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King and its aftermath. We'll talk more about that when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
We have gathered here in his Boston home church to make this clarion statement. You can kill the dreamer, but you cannot kill the dream.
That's the Reverend Dr. Arthur Gerald speaking at the 12th Baptist Memorial Service in honor of Dr. King's memory last night. That was one of many remembrance ceremonies held for King in Boston this week. I'm joined in the special hour by Jason Sokol, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., and also by Walter Fluker. He's the Martin Luther King Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology. And I actually just want to take a quick call here. Rick is calling from Hyde Park. You're on the air, Rick.
Hey, Megna, first off, you adroitly handled the situation. It's very nice today. Your introduction was perfect, and you're doing a great job. And you've been doing a great job for a long time with Iron Man. You handle every topic on different shows perfectly. Now, I got to tell you how I came to where I'm at today. I was 12 years old when Martin Luther King died. I was sitting home in West Philadelphia, and they showed on TV him being carried by a carriage with a donkey. And smoke was coming past my house because they were rioting, and the smoke was such as there's a war zone. And I went outside, and I saw a heavy police force, and it was my first introduction to what white and black was in America. Up until that point, I only had, like, white teachers, right? All black school, public schools, and all white teachers. Consequently, what I got out of seeing the riot was that piggyback on what the other guy said. They've never changed the neighborhoods. If you go to Blue Hill Avenue in Boston, you can still see buildings that were condemned 50 years ago that are still being not built up. We had a theater in West Philadelphia called Nixon Theater. Mm. It was a neighborhood theater. It's a parking lot now because they didn't do anything to it.
Yeah.
My idea was that Black America had no one ever being their leader unless white media told who their leader was. So is it Malcolm, is it Martin, and then we get Obama and he's marginalized.
Yeah.
I read a book by Malcolm X called The Ballot or the Bullet, and I realize now we can't get the ballot or the bullet in America. We can't win by the ballot. We can't win by the bullet.
Rick, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but you've given us a lot to think about, and I want to give Walter Fluker a chance to respond. But Rick, thank you so much for your call. Walter Fluker, what do you make of what Rick's saying?
I heard a lot from Rick.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think about, I was thinking of Gerald Early's comment before Rick, you can kill a dreamer, but you can't kill the dream. And I'm wondering whether we might build from some of these ashes, so to speak, of the past and create a new generation of leaders who, in the image of King, are spiritually disciplined, intellectually astute, and morally anchored. Hmm. I see that as part of the project and the legacy of King. And I don't think we'll ever be able to go back to the kind of harsh economic inequities that are part of what's going on in these cities until we are able to bring to fore these kind of leaders.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Today, in today's New York Times, Reverend Jesse Jackson writes that he of course, sees Dr. King's spirit as being a moral guidepost for mm-hmm. the past half century. And he says that spirit is alive with the high school students of Parkland, Florida.
Yes.
It's alive with the teachers of West Virginia who are blazing a trail for other workers. So I do want to talk more with both of you about sort of the modern legacy of Dr. King. But Jason Sokol, there's something really interesting in your book that you write about in the immediate aftermath, which I hadn't known about. And speaking of Parkland,
okay.
That in the wake of Dr. King's assassination and then Robert Kennedy's just a couple of months later, that brought on a wave of gun control legislation in America.
Yes, indeed. I mean, since President John F. Kennedy's assassination in 63, gun control advocates had been trying to bring legislation to the floor of the Senate. They were stymied each time. Senate Judiciary Committee actually met the day of King's assassination and declined to move a bill to the floor. Well, King was then assassinated by an assailant with a rifle, and 2 days later, they finally moved that legislation to the floor. And then what you saw in the business community then is a lot of what we're seeing now, which is major department stores stopped carrying guns and ammunition, stopped fulfilling mail order sales. And then finally, Robert Kennedy was assassinated June 4th, and the momentum for gun control took off from there to where legislators were finally able to pass the Gun Control Act, which LBJ signed in October of 68.
Hmm. Interesting. So again, to bring us back to the present day, my last question or idea for both of you is, you know, I just kind of want to check ourselves here. in 2018, are we commemorating Dr. King in the right way? And I ask that because, Jason, in your book, you write about the painful process of King's sainthood, you know, put sainthood in quotes. And Jesse Jackson, again, today in the New York Times, says that we owe it to Dr. King to commemorate the man in full, right? As he says, a radical, anti-war, pro-immigrant, scholarly champion of the poor. I mean, Walter Fluker, does America do that right? Or do we only look at sort of one slice of what we want King to mean to us today?
We want him to deliver the I Have a Dream speech. We don't want to hear what Jason is writing about, the nightmare. And I'm convinced that not only is Jesse Jackson correct, but King himself had called for a revolution of values and priorities in American society at the time of his death, which meant that there would be a radical reconstruction around economics, around politics, but most importantly, around the ways in which we interrelate with one another. This will not happen without very astute and morally anchored folks in leadership roles.
Yeah. Jason, tell me more.
A couple things. I mean, King went through a series of evolutions during his career, but there's a couple things that remain constant. One of them was his commitment to civil disobedience, massive civil disobedience if necessary. King thought that wherever injustice prevailed, it was his duty and the duty of other people to get in the streets, to tie up traffic, to shut down American life until that injustice was rooted out. So King would be, of course, on the side of those protesters who are shutting down Sacramento. King would, of course, be kneeling with the athletes who kneel silently and peacefully on a football field. And the fact that some white Americans want to embrace King's legacy while at the same time criticizing those people who are carrying on his legacy of civil disobedience is more than ironic.
Mm. You know, I think about the African-American students at Parkland High School because, of course, by far, most of the media attention has been placed on the young white leaders from the high school. And I'm not denigrating their efforts at all. But you have to think that perhaps Dr. King would feel especially proud of the young black students there who are saying, yes, we are opposed to gun violence, for example, but also let's not be afraid to look at the double or triple or quadruple effect that gun violence has on young black Americans, right?
I agree. I think that King would redirect the movement from just the gaze at white students and ask Americans to look at what's happening in places like Chicago, where their gun violence has rampaged for many years now. But it's only been after white students have been assaulted that we've given serious attention again to the gun control issues. I think King would point us in that direction and say this is not just about white students at Parkland, as important as that is. Yeah. It's also about all Americans, and especially those who live with this daily.
Well, Walter Fluker is the Martin Luther King Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology and editor of the Howard Thurman Papers and director of the MLK Initiative for Development of Ethical Leadership. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Jason Sokol, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. It was a real pleasure to have you. And next time I'm going to invite you back because we can talk about the global response to Dr. King's death.
I would love to. Thank you.
As well. But since we are talking about Dr. King's legacy 50 years after his assassination, I actually wanted to end this show today with the words of Coretta Scott King. Because just 2 days after Dr. King was assassinated, she spoke at a press conference at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. And for as immortal as Dr. King's words are, these words from Coretta Scott King live on powerfully today as well, because she talked about the work that's yet to be done.
So once again, I have put aside traditional family considerations, because my husband's work for his people and for all poor people transcends our wish for privacy. The day that the Negro people and others in bondage are truly free, on the day want is abolished. On the day wars are no more, on that day I know my husband will rest in a long-deserved peace.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.